Thanks for listening to The Business. If you like to get the inside word on the business, and you must if you're listening to this podcast, check out Elvis Mitchell and The Treatment. Each week, Elvis hosts intimate conversations with pop culture luminaries about their influences, their lives, and their work. And each week, you'll be amazed at the insights you hear. Check it out. Find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, what was liberating was knowing that the film has no commercial potential whatsoever. You know, making a film in Polish, which is like automatically it's got no hope of distribution outside.
Filmmaker Paweł Pawlikowski made his movie Ida with the modest hope that it would play at indie theaters in Poland. Now his film about a young nun in training who finds that she is, in fact, Jewish, is up for 2 Oscars. But first, a snapshot of my big Sundance adventure. And on The Banter, we'll talk about what was hot at the festival. Not the weather. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, let's start out with Sundance. I was there. You were certainly closely observing. A lot of deals, some of them really quite big and some of them less big. But as we talked about before, this was a time with a lot of buyers looking for product and a lot of product found buyers.
You know, going into Sundance, a lot of people said, oh, Amazon and Netflix and these digital streaming services are going to be a big player at Sundance, spending money on movies. But at the end of the day, we're seeing the big traditional buyers, the Fox Searchlights, the Sony Classics, the A24s, these independent traditional distributors are the ones that are paying big money, not the streaming services.
Yeah, so Searchlight bought a movie called Brooklyn, which is a tale of an Irish immigrant woman coming here to this country in the 50s. $9 million, I think possibly the biggest deal we know about, right, at the festival at this point.
Yeah, there was some dispute about that because Fox Searchlight bought a film called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which is described as sort of like a Fault in Our Stars type film. And there were some reports that the price had been $12 million. Now, we understand there had been some offers in that range, but the ultimate deal with Fox Searchlight was much lower than that. And there's a significant back-end component where if this film does ultimately turn into Fault in Our Stars, the filmmakers will make more money.
There was a $7 million deal between Sony Pictures Classics and a company called Open Road. $7 million plus a $20 million commitment for marketing. This is for a film called Dope, which is a coming-of-age comedy drama about a kid in a rough neighborhood here in the Los Angeles area. He's trying to get ready to apply to college, and then he gets pulled into a gritty adventure. And that went, as I said, for a pretty big number. And then there were a bunch of smaller deals. I managed to catch a movie called The End of the Tour, which is Jason Segel playing author David Foster Wallace being interviewed by Jesse Eisenberg as a Rolling Stone reporter. This is based on real events. I liked it a lot. It went for $2 or $3 million to A24. And again, it's not a commercial movie, but it's one of the few that I saw that actually sold. So that was good. And The Bronze, you know, we talked about The Bronze in the previous banter. This was the sort of a raunchy comedy about an unhappy, washed-up gymnast. That didn't sell for all that much. It was supposed to be one of, this happens at Sundance. It was supposed to be one of the buzziest, hottest titles. And when people saw it, I heard very kind of mixed things, and it didn't go for a big number.
No, people tended to talk about one very acrobatic sex scene in the movie. And when they're talking about that and not the quality, it's probably not a good sign.
Yeah, so it went for $3 million, which is not nothing, but it wasn't the hot ticket that everybody thought it would be. Now, let me just transition from Sundance to the Oscar race. A couple of big developments since we last sized that thing up. Notably, the Producers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild voting Birdman as Best Picture, which certainly seems to unseat what seemed to be the front runner, Boyhood. And meanwhile, American Sniper doing unbelievable business and yet probably not looking strong in the awards race.
Yeah, I think after all the critics groups voted and the Golden Globes, people thought Boyhood just was going to have a run to the Oscars. It has that narrative behind it, the 12 years in the making story. And then all of a sudden, you got these two groups saying, no, we prefer Birdman. So I think really now it is that two-horse race. But the interesting thing here is how much of a non-factor American Sniper is, considering how well it's doing at the box office and how much it's galvanized movie going.
Yeah, it's open to record-breaking numbers. It's a huge, huge hit, especially we don't consider that sort of thing likely to be coming out from Clint Eastwood, a quality filmmaker, but not necessarily this kind of gigantic box office. And it's been extremely polarizing.
I mean, I think Warner Brothers has handled this extremely well. Their marketing hits it right down the middle. If you are very anti-war, you can take a message from that. If you are interested in the hero narrative, you can take that from this film. And I think that they are laughing all the way to the bank at this just ongoing battle over what the message of the movie is.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd love to collect some statuettes, but really they want the money, and it is going great guns. And it's, you know, they never saw it coming. I asked a Warner's executive a few months ago what they saw as their big movies coming up, and I don't even think American Sniper was mentioned. They talked about The Hobbit and skipped ahead. So that one is a curveball, and it shows you how show business is. You don't know what is going to work.
The one thing that it had going for it is that they, you know, they started releasing this in December as a traditional kind of award-style platform movie, and the numbers from those limited releases were astronomical. And they opened it in New York, Los Angeles, and Dallas because Chris Kyle had a, you know, big following there in Dallas.
The person on whom the film is based, yeah.
Yes. I mean, these were like 75,000 per theater, which is a huge number and breaking records in small release. So to take that number and then to go wide with it and get up to $200 million in 2 weeks is just nuts.
It's just nuts. And speaking of nuts on the TV side, TV has a huge new hit in Empire. This is on the Fox network and comes from the Fox studio. And the Fox network had been getting kicked around as being in the basement and, you know, is the newest punching bag. It wasn't doing well. Idol was fading. Things weren't working. And out comes Empire. This is a thing from Lee Daniels. It stars Terrence Howard as the head of a family that is very big in the hip-hop world. Taraji Henson is his estranged wife who comes out of prison and is looking to grab back onto this gigantic empire that her former husband has built. And this thing also opened to a big number. And then the real phenomenon is it's continued to grow as it went along.
Yeah, I mean, it's been about two decades since a drama on a broadcast network has grown in its second and third week, the way that this show has. And it is getting a huge tune-in from African-American audiences. About 61% of the 18 to 49 audience is African-American, according to Nielsen. But it's also managing to bring in younger viewers. It's managing to bring in women. It's sort of this niche show that became a gigantic cross-the-board hit.
Yeah, and it's making broadcast executives, even at competitor networks, thrilled because people had been, you know, increasingly writing off broadcast and saying, well, that was then and this is now. And even at competitor networks, they're saying, look what we can do. It's still the big tent. So it's really cheered them up.
It's also worth noting that we've now had three shows this season, Empire, How to Get Away with Murder on ABC, and Black-ish on ABC, that have been hits and are targeting an African-American audience or diverse audience. So you're seeing that this diversity mantra that you hear so often in Hollywood, why aren't there more diverse shows? You're seeing that when you actually put it together, you can have success here.
If you do a good job. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. You may have heard the buzz at Sundance around the documentary Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. The film's premiere on Sunday, January 25th, was one of the hottest tickets at the festival. Alec Baldwin, Tobey Maguire, and New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd were all in the audience. The crowds were so big that some festival goers who had tickets were turned away. The film is based on the book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright, who's been a guest on our show. Its director, Alex Gibney, also was a guest for his 2013 film, The Armstrong Lie. I've covered Scientology on and off over the years, and several months ago, Gibney asked if I would do an interview for his then-in-the-works Scientology movie. I said yes. I got nervous when I heard a few weeks ago that my interview hadn't hit the cutting room floor and that the film would play at Sundance. I've been to Sundance many times, but only as an observer. It never occurred to me that I might one day actually be in a Sundance film. And I realized I've been on television many times, but I've never actually seen myself on a big screen. I joked to my friends that if they heard a scream during the premiere, it wouldn't be an angry Scientologist, but me, reacting to the sight of my giant talking head. Scientology had already indicated its objection to the film, which includes harrowing tales from a number of former Scientologists. The church took out full-page ads in the New York and Los Angeles Times. Given the organization's reputation for hardball tactics against its critics, there were concerns about security. But when our producer, Caitlin Parker, and I ran into Gibney in Park City a couple of days before the movie played, he said he was ready for whatever might come. While there had been some discussion about whether to run a normal Q&A with the audience after the screening, Gibney said he had insisted on going ahead.
I wanted this screening, even though it's about an organization whose reputation precedes it in terms of being extremely aggressive with people who criticize it. Still, my view was that it should adhere to the spirit of the festival, and we'd run the Q&A exactly like any other Q&A.
It seemed there was some reason to wonder who from the Church of Scientology might be in the audience. A producer on the John Travolta Scientology-inspired bomb, Battlefield Earth, had requested tickets. And after the screening, longtime Scientology critic and blogger Tony Ortega said he and a former Scientologist who had been an important source for Gibney's film both noticed something when they got to Salt Lake City en route to the festival.
Mark Henley and I were both photographed by the same private investigator at the airport when we arrived.
Once the screening started, I managed to watch myself in the movie without indulging that self-critical voice most of us sometimes hear in our heads. And when the movie ended, I got a chance to experience something else that I had never expected.
So I'd like to invite the people who are in the film and are here to come on up.
So there I was, standing in front of a wildly applauding Sundance audience in a group that included several former Scientologists, two of whom had been critically important sources for me over the years, and one of whom had actually been a very high-level church official who in the past had tried to fend me off and even spook me a little when I was working on stories about Scientology. For years, Mike Rinder had denounced others who had left the church as apostates and liars, but now he's changed his tune.
It is a prison of belief, and unless you can break that down, it doesn't matter what else you do. The hope of this film and the bravery of Alex and Larry and others who have gone before him is that it will raise public awareness.
As it happened, there were no antagonistic questions from the very receptive audience at the premiere. If there were representatives from Scientology in the room, they remained silent. But the minute the question and answer session was over, Sundance volunteers formed a human chain, blocking anyone in the audience from approaching those of us who had been involved with the film. We were hustled out of the door so quickly that I found myself standing outside in the chilly Park City afternoon without a coat. But it was worth it for an experience I don't expect to have again in the foreseeable future or possibly ever. The Church of Scientology continues to express its displeasure with the film and has started placing promoted tweets suggesting that Going Clear is the equivalent of the discredited campus rape story that ran in Rolling Stone. The documentary will play in theaters in New York and Los Angeles before it airs on HBO March 16th. Filmmaker Paweł Pawlikowski's Ida is another film with a Sundance connection. The Polish indie about a young nun who learns that she's really a Jew played in Park City last year and became a favorite on the festival circuit, winning awards in Toronto and at the BFI Fest in London. Pawlikowski never imagined that his small black and white art house film would even be seen outside Poland. Now it's an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Picture and Best Cinematography. Having spent much of his childhood in Warsaw, Pawlikowski moved to London as a teenager and later made English-language films like My Summer of Love, which put actress Emily Blunt on the map. He also made a movie in France, but he's moved back to Warsaw, and Ida is his first feature from his home country. Pawlikowski had a good sense of what it takes to make an independent film in other parts of Europe. As for the film industry in Poland, Pawlikowski describes it as functioning.
There is state sponsorship. There's a film institute that invests money in sort of non-commercial films. But traditionally, you know, Polish film industry was pretty good, especially under communism, you know, where the money was not an issue.
Right.
So in the late 50s, early 60s, 70s, 80s, it was very vibrant.
It's a little counterintuitive to think that under a communist regime, you'd have a thriving film,
industry. Well, it was public sponsorship. It's like studio system.
But there's also the censorship question.
You know, it did encourage filmmakers to talk about stuff imaginatively and indirectly, you know, using metaphors, which sometimes is good for art, strangely, you know. you know, like a really totalitarian state suddenly relents a bit. And that's what happened in Poland in 56 after Stalin's death, you know, that kind of there was a period of relative liberalism. And that small margin of freedom that emerged suddenly became valuable. People grabbed it with both hands and started making incredible art. So it was a kind of blessed period. Then that finished sort of in 60, 65, 68. You know, suddenly the kind of communist authorities got tougher, the censorship got stricter. But the culture back then was actually more vibrant than it is today, paradoxically. Because nowadays it is very much, you know, it's a kind of total free market in Poland. And people are very aware of bottom line and, you know, how everything translates into you know, sales and into viewers.
So how does your genesis as a filmmaker fit into that? You were brought up in Poland and...
I lived when I was 14. So in 71, I found myself in London, which I kind of adored, you know, with all the rock music around at the time. Then I kind of went to university in England, did a PhD in... Well, I actually didn't finish my PhD, but, you know, attempted at Oxford in philology and philosophy. And then I started making films. First, like shorts, experimental shorts that didn't make any sense at all, but they were all very pretentious and poetic as hell. Then I made documentaries for the BBC, well, not for the BBC, for BBC Money in the mid-80s to mid-90s. And that was like my favorite time of filmmaking time because I could just invent any old subject.
For the BBC.
And BBC was then a kind of, it wasn't the corporation that it is today. It was a kind of gentleman's club largely with these pockets of, was like, you know, commissioning editors who had a lot of autonomy and they could just commission stuff that had no commercial purpose at all. So I had a wonderful time making documentaries in Central Eastern Europe. I did, you know, one in Bosnia at the very beginning of the war. I did a few in Russia.
You know, that sounds like kind of a dream. You get to go and make whatever you want, and nobody
fantastic.
Cares if it's commercial.
It felt a bit like a kind of socialist utopia again. You know, like there's no focus groups. I didn't have to worry about the, you know, where the budget came from for a while. Then that changed in more or less 95. The BBC became properly corporatized, and you couldn't just kind of disappear and make a film. It had to be part of a kind of overall strategy of the corporation. So I just kind of dropped out, started writing more, inventing my own stories. And then I just kind of made films in Britain until 4 years ago I went to make a film in France. And now I've come home to Poland to my first Polish film.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out how it works since the financing is always such a difficult thing.
Basically, all over Europe, you have these sort of state subsidies and regional subsidies. You know, you have to kind of know your way around it. Not me, but the producers. With Ida, it was... It wasn't easy, but it was, obviously it has to be relatively cheap because, you know, it's a black and white film in Polish with unknown actors, you know, and kind of shot in a particular way. The Polish Film Institute put up half the finance and the other half we kind of had to kind of just look around for. Europe has a strong sense that culture is worth preserving. So there's a
Fancy
lot of...
that.
I know. So these different institutes trying to make common cause. So when we got some money, not very much, but some money from Denmark, that made it possible to access another fund called the Eurimage. You know, when you have two European countries producing a film, then there's some extra funds that can be tapped into from the European Union. So suddenly, and then the city of Łódź, when we shot some of the film, put some money in. But it was a bit of scraping a budget together. It wasn't easy.
Coming up after a short break, Pawlikowski auditioned more than 400 young women for the title role in Ida. He tells us how he finally found his Ida, not in an audition, but at a coffee shop. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Paweł Pawlikowski. His film Ida has been a favorite at festivals and now is Oscar-nominated for Best Foreign Language Picture and Best Cinematography. Set in early 1960s Poland, Pawlikowski's film tells the story of two women, the young aspiring nun, Ida, played by Agata Czebuchowska, and her aunt Wanda, played by Agata Kulesza. Ida is an orphan who grew up in a convent, but before she's allowed to take her vows, she's sent to meet her aunt, a hard-drinking prosecutor who'd been associated with the Stalinist regime. Ida learns that she is in fact Jewish, and together the two women set out to learn where and how Ida's parents had died during World War II. Shot in black and white, Ida is stark and austere, and the camera remains largely stationary. When he set out to find funding for the project, Pawlikowski knew he'd have to temper his expectations.
I don't think this kind of film is common these days, no. You know, what was liberating was knowing that the film has no commercial potential whatsoever. You know, making a film in Polish, which is like automatically it's got no hope of distribution outside. Because, you know, only 40 million people speak Polish on this globe.
Is that how you pitched it to your financiers? You know, like, we're not going to make a dime here, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's be honest. But it was very liberating in some other ways that I could just, you know, shoot it as I wanted, frame it as I wanted, shoot it in black and white, and cast it, you know, without worrying about casting it up to raise the finance. So I had, like, total freedom at a price. I mean, the film was relatively cheap.
Yeah, I mean, was there anything you had to give up because you had to make it inexpensively?
No, it was totally proportionate with itself, the budget, you know. I kind of knew this is what it is and, you know, let's work within it. We didn't build much. You know, I spent a lot of time looking for locations and looking for actors. Time was the real expense.
Well, your lead was not an actress. I read that you had seen her at a cafe, and I'm really trying to visualize the scene in my mind where you walk up to some woman who's sitting in a cafe
and say, hey,
you want to be in a movie? It just doesn't sound that good, actually.
Oh, well, I know. No, it's even more complicated than that. I mean, it was, but if you want, I'll tell you the full story. But
go ahead.
I was looking for a young actress for months and months, and I auditioned like maybe 400. Couldn't find the right one.
400, and what was not there?
Ida's a very particular creature, you know. She's very sociologically, psychologically, anthropologically, she's very unusual. And not of today, you know. She obviously hasn't watched TV ever.
Right.
And it's kind of difficult to find people who can kind of embody that. And then I told all my friends in Warsaw, please look out because I'm desperate. You know, the time is approaching and I've got absolutely nobody. And then one of my friends who lives near me rang me up. I was in Paris at the time and said, I'm sitting in a cafe across from a interesting looking young woman. I don't know what exactly you're looking for, but she's interesting. So I said, you know, take a secret iPhone photograph and send it to me. So she sent it to me. Agata, that's who it was, looked nothing like what I was looking for because she had a kind of hipster hairstyle and really cool clothes. But there was something striking about her. So via my friend, I contacted her.
Oh my goodness.
Then it turned out that she'd seen my films, you know, and My Summer of Love was her favorite film, you know, that kind of changed their life, so she claimed. So she wanted to meet me, but she wasn't interested in being in a film at all. She just kind of wanted to meet me. But then we started talking and, you know, we got on really well and she was brilliant, really, really clever, intelligent, grounded woman. So I thought, God, I've got to put her in, you know, especially since when you took off the kind of hipsterish exterior, she was great. She did look like a timeless creature.
Something out potentially of a Flemish painting from the 1500s. Yeah.
And just the whole aura and her behavior, there was something special about her. On top of that, she was an atheist, which was like all the candidates for the part who came into the auditions claimed that they were very religious or they were very religious, that they always wanted to be nuns. And whereas she was very kind of straightforward, like, I am a totally atheist, I have no time for religion. And because she was so honest and straightforward, she did feel right for it. So, yeah, so that's how we found her.
And the aunt, who is such a pivotal figure.
She's one of the kind of well-known actresses, theater actresses in Poland. And, of course, if you look for somebody who's over 40, you can't find unknowns, you know. So I looked among the knowns, and she was by far the best for the part. And I saw her in a play where she was brilliant. I didn't even need to audition her. I kind of just met her and knew she was right.
So you thought it was going to be like seen by a few, maybe 20 people in Poland, mm-hmm. and then it breaks out. How does that happen?
I don't know. I mean, it did very well at festivals. You know, it was shown in Telluride and Toronto. It started winning awards. And then it hit some chord, you know. Obviously, a lot of people really kind of loved it. And I'm still mystified how it works. But it wasn't just in the States. I mean, it was like in France, it was really popular, and in Spain.
It did $3 million in France, and much less so in the UK. It's 600,000.
But UK art house is not a big phenomenon anyway, but it's still the biggest grossing Polish-speaking film ever, probably, in the UK.
So okay, there you go.
It's all relative.
But France really... Went for it.
Like 600,000 people saw it, which is great.
I'm curious about the Netflix release of the film. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much say you have as the director mm-hmm. of the film.
None at all.
None at all. No. Okay. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, because I read a quote, which I will read to you. You said you wanted the film to be visually striking because I wanted the images to be as strong as the performances. I wanted them to have an emotional impact through the composition, through the framing and the mm-hmm. lighting. So is that something that when you think of people seeing it on a small screen or maybe even a really small screen,
not think about that.
You'd rather not
but
think
then
about
I have
that.
So little, you know, in the end, once a film goes out into the world, you have so little control.
So you just say, I'm going to avert my gaze.
So I'm just trying. Let's not be too precious. You know, it's just you just have to just forget about controlling everything. I'm a control freak enough as it is.
Well, you're here. You're obviously on an Oscar campaign. What does it mean to be doing that? That seems like something that would be, I think, quite flattering in some ways, but also kind of like, how did I get here?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. How did I get here? I'm not used to campaigning and, I'm not used to it. I usually make films which are not so successful. So I, you know, make a film and spend a few months promoting it or talking to audiences and then disappear back into the woodwork, whereas this has been going on for years, so it's kind of unusual.
It's sort of a terrible question, but do you think an Oscar win would change things for you professionally?
Well, not for me. No, because I still have to do my own stuff, you know? So it's not like I'm sort of pursuing some career. I just make one film after another.
And you don't think it would make the financing easier in the future?
Well, not the sort of films I make, you know? I don't think it's, maybe a little bit lighter, but in the end, it's if you don't work with famous actors and if you don't do kind of genre scripts, you know, you always have to struggle and start from small, you know? And it gives you freedom as well not to have too big budgets anyway, so it's not a... No, but the main thing is you know, is the creative side. That's the real problem, you know, inventing a film, then shaping it, then seeing it through. And that takes like 2-3 years of your life. And the financing is a problem, but it's not the main problem. The main problem is the creative side of things, always.
You said that if you were to win an Oscar, mm-hmm. it would prove my theory that I never fully believed in, that if you do your own thing, sometimes the world will come around to you rather than having to run after the audience, run after the money, run after success. I've always said that, but it never happened until now. Mm-hmm. I always say that to my students you teach, but it never statistically happened.
Yeah, that's true, sadly. Never. If it happens once in a lifetime, it's great, no?
Yeah.
Then the theory has currency for a while.
So does this affect how you're going to be teaching those students of yours?
Well, I try to, you know, if they have a talent and a personality, then of course they should push that as far as it goes, you know, because that's the rare commodity these days. I mean, everybody knows how to make movies nowadays. The more difficult is to find something to say and to have like a sensibility which is there on the screen, you know, your taste in humans, in actors, in music, in images, you know, all these things, you can't kind of engineer them. If you have them, then you should cultivate them and see how far it gets you.
Pavel Pawlikowski is the director of Ida, now available on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.